Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 8. When I let the pets out for their first romp early the next morning, I found a folded sheet of dew-soaked, pale green paper taped to my door, and assumed some night owl acquaintance stopped by after I'd gone to bed and left me a note. Consequently, when I pried the wet edges apart and read, "You will never make it through your seminar alive," in barely legible, computer-generated dot matrix letters, it didn't immediately register. When it did, I screamed at the pets to come into the house. Immediately! And slammed and locked the door when they did. Then I sat down at the kitchen table and stared at the limp piece of paper. Some kid probably found an old computer and printer in his grandparents' attic and is sending notes to everyone as a joke, I tried to convince myself. But when my hands kept shaking and I felt like I was going to throw up, I disregarded the fact that it was barely dawn and called McCarthy. The time didn't matter, though, because neither he nor his answering machine answered. Feeling even more panicky, I fired up the computer with the idea of emailing him. When I did, I saw that a message from him awaited me. "Have gone out of town for a few days. Stay put. I'll call when I get back." I couldn't believe it. "All right, I'll call the police and let them handle it," I told the cat. That approach bombed when visions of trying to explain everything to them filled my mind. Then I tried the approach I'd used many times since Bob died. Denial. I just wouldn't think about it. I'd concentrate on my work instead. Knowing that an approach that enabled me to forget about a cheating dead spouse might not work, particularly since it hadn't when somebody bashed me on the head, I nonetheless immersed myself in my work because I couldn't think of anything else to do. Throughout the day, I organized and reorganized my lecture material in an effort to block out the threat and all the terrifying thoughts that evoked. But by that evening, I found it was so impossible to concentrate, I picked up Bloodbath in Barcelona in hopes of distracting myself. 5 pages later, when McCarthy's villain shot Will Ravencroft's girlfriend, an undercover agent disguised as a nun, using an ultra-secret, sawed-off, high-powered weapon that sent her eyeballs flying into a nearby olive grove, I decided to go to bed. Unfortunately, the same vivid imagination that helps me unravel some very complex human-animal interactions works against me when I face the unknown. As I lay in bed, eyeballs rained down on me from the vaulted ceiling above and made sleep impossible. In desperation, I mentally summoned my seminar notes in an attempt to distract myself. Try as I might, though, I couldn't keep the memory of McCarthy's letter to DeWitt and his sudden disappearance from intruding. Once that happened, my mind filled with an image of him consulting with one of his good friends in the CIA, plotting to drive me crazy because I knew about the goat. Then he'd kill me, just like he killed Monica. No, he couldn't do that. Not the same way. I hugged Elizabeth so hard she grunted. But could McCarthy drive me crazy and kill me some other way? Probably. He'd already made me feel crazy on more than one occasion. Given his credentials and my strange work and increasingly solitary lifestyle since Bob's death, I knew he could convince everyone I'd gone round the bend if he set that meticulous mind of his to it. Once he did that, an unfortunate accident or overdose probably would raise as little suspicion of foul play as Monica's death had. "Let's face it," I told Elizabeth, who happily snuggled against me once I relaxed my grip. "He could know everything about me, and all I know about him is what was in that college newsletter. With his connections, even that could be a pack of lies." In an effort to block out these disturbing thoughts, I ran other scenarios with Douglas DeWitt, Jeff Weintraub, and Hal Winthrop as threat printers and killers in an effort to eliminate McCarthy. Unfortunately, I easily envisioned all of them driving me crazy and doing me in too. That so depressed me, I gave up any thought of sleep and got up at 1 a.m. When I let the cat out and found another note taped to the door, my fear and paranoia spiraled upward. When I went grocery shopping at 8, I found a thread on the dashboard of my car. When I came home, another sheet of folded green paper taped to the front door waved at me in the light breeze. When I caught up my email to see if anything from McCarthy awaited me, a message from Jim Godfrey saying they'd found traces of xylazine in the tissue sample greeted me. "Oh, yippee," I muttered to the dogs as I deleted the incriminating report. "I can die in peace knowing someone anesthetized a goat to get it up here and keep it quiet." After I phoned McCarthy about 10 times and checked for email from him so many times I feared I'd wear out my computer, I began to question my own sanity. "Why do I so desperately want to ask someone who might want to kill me for help?" I asked myself as I pried the cat off the birdcage. The answer to that question made me feel crazier than ever, because there wasn't anyone else. I passed another sleepless night going over my seminar material, this time with a pillow wrapped around my head so I wouldn't hear any tiptoeing up the gravel walk to the front door. The next morning I peeled another thread off the door and added it to the growing pile. "There are too many of them," I waved the papers at the pets. "Someone just wants to scare me, not kill me." Teresa stared up at me solemnly. Maddie wrapped himself around my ankles, and Elizabeth grinned and wriggled her stumpy tail. When they rushed past me into the yard, I realized I'd reverted to habit and left the door unlocked the night before. "That proves it," I told my cavorting companions with far more certainty than I felt. "Whoever's doing it could have waltzed right in and murdered me in my bed if you really wanted to." Although the unlocked door reassured me somewhat, it told me nothing about who would do such a thing or why. The day before the seminar, I congratulated myself for agreeing to stay at the hotel where the meeting was being held. Months before, when I was invited to speak, I'd almost declined the program director's offers because of the hotel's nearby location on the periphery of the Hanover College campus. However, he persisted, and finally I capitulated, telling myself I'd relax before the event, get to the convention center bright and early the next morning, and get a good night's sleep after the festivities following the meeting. When I began receiving the threats, I initially hesitated to ask my pet sitter to stay in my home, fearing something terrible would happen to the young woman. But as the pile of threats grew, I convinced myself she would come to no harm. What few doubts lingered vanished when I read that morning's warning. "Tomorrow is the big day. See you there." Whether a sick joke or a real danger, whoever was threatening me clearly intended to string me along to the very end. I neatly piled the clothes I planned to take on my bed and went into the bathroom to collect my cosmetics and grooming aids. As I slipped my toothbrush into its traveling case, the haggard reflection staring dully back at me from the mirror made it clear that the sleepless nights had taken their toll. On the other hand, all those hours spent going over my material guaranteed that I could give the seminar in my sleep. Hell! I chuckled grimly to myself as I tossed my toothbrush and deodorant into my cosmetic bag with my makeup. I could probably give it dead. When I checked into the hotel shortly after 7 that evening, the registration desk was so short-staffed and crowded with convention-goers I didn't get to my room until almost an hour later. A nice, long, hot shower and then bed. I yawned my evening plans to the empty room as I unpacked my few belongings. However, as soon as I stepped beneath the noisy cascade of water, my fatigued mind immediately summoned the vision of a man in a ski mask silently picking the lock of my hotel room door, then sneaking into the bathroom where he now stood on the other side of the shower curtain with a meat cleaver. The image became so vivid I couldn't get past it to turn off the water and get out of the tub. Finally, in desperation, I grabbed a container of shampoo, whipped open the shower curtain, screamed like a banshee, and hurled the shampoo at no one. By the time I cleaned up the shampoo, I felt almost normal, until I saw the folded sheet of pale green paper lying on the rug just inside the door. For the third night in a row, I tossed and turned. Only this time I cried out involuntarily, and my body lurched spastically when the door slammed up and down the hallway as other occupants came and went. By the next morning, I felt so frazzled, I saw no way I could present 6 hours of lecture, let alone accomplish all the necessary professional bonding rituals that went with it. "But you have to," announced a pathetic, baggy-eyed hag who stared at me from the mirror, "to get it out of your head." Which was true. If I didn't give the seminar, I'd spend the rest of my life going over that same material just like I had for the past 3 days. That would be worse than getting killed. That would be hell. For some reason, this line of hardly logical thought comforted me, and I picked up yet another threat from the rug in front of the door almost nonchalantly, neatly folded it, and slipped it into my purse with the others. I had already decided that I wanted the threats with me so that when the police found my dead body, they'd be sorry they didn't investigate Monica Sanko's death more thoroughly. I doubted they would, of course. Either feel sorry or investigate Monica's death more thoroughly. But it made me feel better. After I dressed, I waited until I heard voices in the hallway, then opened the door and insinuated myself in the middle of a group heading for the elevator. At first I felt guilty about my decision to surround myself with as many people as possible until the seminar ended, because I knew I'd feel terrible if some innocent bystander got killed when I did. But I was too scared to care. "I'll just do my best to make sure that doesn't happen," I muttered to myself grimly as I squeezed between two very large men filling their plates at the breakfast buffet. I moved when they did and, by the time I reached the end of the serving area, was horrified to discover a huge mound of food on my plate. Although normally I would have sought a table for one in a remote corner, that day I seated myself at the largest, most crowded table I could find. Luckily, good manners prevented the other diners from saying anything about my intrusion or the obscene amount of food on my plate that I poked at rather than ate. When they got up, I got up, then joined another group heading toward the auditorium where my seminar was being held. Throughout all this, I heard myself exchanging polite comments and cheerful banter. But inside my head, two eyes continuously scanned my surroundings, constantly monitoring them for any sign hinting at impending danger. The morning session passed uneventfully, or as uneventfully as it could, given that I expected to be shot dead at any minute. Those attending appeared genuinely interested in the subject matter, asked intelligent questions, and offered insights from their own experience that expanded my views. My facade only wavered once, when I noticed Douglas DeWitt slip through a side door and take a seat near the back of the auditorium. His presence unnerved me, but I took comfort from knowing that one potential killer was where I could keep an eye on him. During the break, I once again planted myself in the center of a group, this time one of students who offered little in the way of camouflage. My tailored navy suit and white silk blouse stuck out in that relaxed crew like an evening gown at a greased pig contest. Nonetheless, I hunkered down among them, chattering gaily until my untouched coffee grew cold and the break finally ended. When the meeting recessed for lunch 2 hours later, I knew I had to eat something or I'd never make it through the afternoon. So once again I wedged myself between two solid conventioneers at yet another buffet and filled my plate. Once again I seated myself at a crowded table. But then I glanced up and saw Barbara Fujama talking to Jeff Weintraub and Hal Winthrop in the hallway. Both men turned and looked in my direction, but neither acknowledged my presence. I put down my fork without taking a bite. During the afternoon session, the two inner eyes, constantly surveying the crowd, grew larger and larger until they took up most of my head. I still presented my material, the group still laughed in the right places and asked the appropriate questions that I evidently answered appropriately because they looked satisfied. But following every question and answer session, when I darkened the room to resume my lectures with its accompanying slides, someone moved across the back of the auditorium and stood directly in front of me, a movement I sensed rather than saw. The fact that this person stood in the dark while the bright light of the podium spotlighted me evoked terrifying images of poachers jacking defenseless deer. At the same time, and equally distressing, the primitive, survival-oriented part of my mind surveying the room took on explicitly feline characteristics. Every rustling paper drew my immediate attention. I held my body tense, ready to spring or flee in an instant. I flexed my fingers repeatedly. Had I possessed claws, I would have unsheathed them. Rather than constantly deal with such sensations, I increased the number of question and answer sessions to lengthen the periods of light and shorten those of darkness. By the time I answered the last question and collected my materials, I felt like a 115-pound sack of used kitty litter. All I wanted was something to eat, a long hot shower, and a nice comfortable bed. Even death was beginning to sound good. The sudden appearance of the program director's hand on my shoulder caused me to yelp in surprise, then laugh to cover my embarrassment. "Don't forget you're coming to the house for cocktails with the others, then we'll all go out for a late dinner," he announced, looking over my head and waving to someone in the herd charging out the door. "I've arranged for you to ride with a group from your floor." He moved on before I could refuse. The idea of phoning my host with some excuse that would allow me to stay at the hotel appealed to me until I got to my room and found another threat lying on the dull gray carpeting. Then the idea of freshening up and contributing my share to the festivities immediately won out. Once surrounded by the crush of guests, my newfound energy rapidly dissipated, and I struggled to cope with the riot of stimuli assaulting me. The beat of 60s and 70s rock music merged with the tinkling of glasses, laughter, and snippets of conversation to create a sound collage that soon overwhelmed me. My ragged mind interpreted the other guests' most inconsequential gestures as threatening, and I flinched constantly. When the man standing next to me suddenly turned and raised his arm, and I automatically spun to defend myself, the whole room began to swim dangerously. "Are you all right?" A pair of very blue eyes materialized out of the swirling sea of humanity around me. McCarthy. I thought about asking him to get me out of there before I threw up, fainted, or otherwise made a fool of myself, and maybe I actually did. Because the next thing I knew, I was sitting in his car with my head between my knees. When things finally stopped spinning enough that I could look up, I saw him leaning against the open car door with his arms folded across his chest, watching me. "McCarthy, do you want to kill me?" I verbalized the most troublesome of the many fears that had plagued me during the preceding 3 days. He gave me a cautious look reminiscent of Maddie approaching his first snake. I admit the thought did cross my mind on one occasion. He paused and looked thoughtful while what little remained of my almost depleted adrenaline supply surged insipidly. "Twice, come to think of it, but I have no current plans. Why?" His coldly clinical reply so startled me, I lost it. "What do you mean you wanted to kill me?" I punched him as hard as I could. "What kind of psychopathic bastard are you?" He grabbed my arm, stuffed it and me in the car, slammed the door, and got into the driver's seat beside me. "Are you trying to tell me something again?" "Of course I am, you idiot," I shouted at him angrily. "I'm trying to tell you someone wants to kill me." I snatched a pile of threats from my purse and threw them at him. When I saw the surprised look on his face when he read them, such a tremendous wave of relief and embarrassment rolled over me, I began to cry. "Take me to the nearest bus stop," I blubbered. I want to go to that hotel. No, home. No, I don't know where. Just take me there." "There aren't any bus stops. We're 5 miles from the nearest main road." "Then call me a damn cab." "Why don't I take you to the nearest police station?" he suggested with that same maddening calmness. "Why don't you take up naked alligator wrestling?" I pounded the dashboard angrily. "Are you nuts?" "Am I missing something here?" came his stark, amphibious reply. "What exactly would you like me to say to the police, Einstein?" that some terrorist started threatening to kill me the same day the man who's here looking for a stolen goat and supposedly helping me find a killer went off to God knows where, if anywhere, for a while? Or how about there's a killer loose, but thanks to them we'll never find him because a professional cleaning service they so helpfully recommended destroyed all the evidence? The hard look in my crazy partner's eyes made it clear he didn't appreciate my version of the situation. He started the car. Where are we going? I reached for the door handle just as he hit the automatic door lock. Someplace safe. He quickly put the car in gear and pulled out onto the road. Where's that? I suspected that his and my definitions of a safe place might differ. A reasonable suspicion. My place, came another of his pathologically calm replies. You are nuts, aren't you? I eyed him critically. No one sent any death threats to me there. My exhausted to the point of numb mind pondered that dementedly serene reply and decided it made sense. But it would also make sense if he were the one who sent the threats. McCarthy, are you sure you don't want to kill me? I tried once again to nail down at least this one point before my adrenaline petered out completely. No. His grip on the steering wheel tightened. I am not sure, but I didn't send those threats. Oh, all right then, I'll go with you, I said agreeably, as if I weren't locked in a car going 40 miles an hour down a deserted back road. He looked at me as if I'd lost my mind, but by then I was too tired to care. I must have dozed off. Otherwise, why would McCarthy have announced, "We're here," would seem like mere seconds later. I staggered out of the car and preceded him up the walk and into a featureless brick apartment building, then leaned against the wall while he extracted a small key ring containing a single key and a poodle charm with ruby-red rhinestone eyes from his pocket. Nice touch, I snickered tiredly. It belongs to my landlady, he harumphed as he unlocked the door. He flipped on the light switch, then stepped aside for me to enter. You live here? I incredulously surveyed the jarring assortment of garish furniture, all overseen by a breathtakingly bad, life-size portrait of an overly endowed young woman with what looked like a collection of small melons floating around her head. My landlady, McCarthy offered dryly with a fleeting glance in the picture's direction. Unfortunately, many, many years ago. What are those melons around her head? They're not melons, they're Bubbles, he informed me somewhat irritably. That's her name, Bubbles. Her husband painted it before he died. I politely turned away and told myself I must not mention what a lucky day it was for the art world when Mr. Bubbles died. Nor would I laugh. I only half succeeded. You have mermaids on your bathroom wall, don't you? I snickered, convinced with much less than a reasonable doubt that he did. He looked at me as if I'd accused him of wearing an underwired bra. It's only temporary housing, he bellowed. Who gives a damn about the bloody mermaids? He pointed to a bright aqua, pseudo-Danish modern couch. I sat and watched him storm around the neon pink kitchenette, slamming cupboard doors and dinnerware, and, finally, two pink plastic plates of microwave fare on the pink formica top table. Then he pointed to one of the not-quite-matching molded pink plastic chairs. I dragged myself off the couch and sat as directed, then stared at the plate of boiled gray rice topped with an assortment of amorphous brownish-gray lumps glistening in a pool of fluorescent red sauce. "What is this?" I asked pleasantly, hoping to put things back on a more civilized footing. "Food." He gave me what I considered a fine imitation of a Nubian goat. I was about to say that I knew that, but then I looked down at my plate and decided that wasn't true. What kind of food? I poked at one of the lumps tentatively with my fork, then recoiled when it quivered. Chinese, number 7. McCarthy gestured with his fork toward the pink counter where two soggy white cardboard containers lay on their sides like dead albino rats. Excuse me? Number 7. On the menu. He unscrewed the cap from a bottle of white wine and filled two pink plastic tumblers. It's the fastest one they make. But what is it? I felt my grasp on reality slipping again. I told you, Chinese, number 7, the fastest. Better eat it while it's hot. It sticks together when it gets cold. Plus, we've got a lot of work to do. Work? The word sounded obscene to someone who only wanted to curl up in the corner of his ugly couch and sleep. I'll tell you after you eat. He gave me a look even one of his beloved Limex would know meant he didn't intend to say another word. And he didn't until I ate all the number 7 on my plate. Every last, unidentifiable, rapidly congealing lump of it. It wasn't good, but it was filling. When I finished, I leaned back and closed my eyes for a moment. When I opened them, he was holding my blood-spattered business card in front of me. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.